Connecting commerce to your community. Bridgeport Regional Business Council President and CEO Dan Onofrio. Now on Melissa in the Morning. On WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
Hey, Dan, welcome back to the show. How are you?
I'm good, Melissa. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Thank you so much. I was curious. I haven't heard about any local businesses per se being involved with this, but earlier this week, I was reading an article, and it was more of an opinion article, so take it as a grain of salt. But it was talking about businesses making statements and whether or not it's good for them. So I think you and I had talked about this actually a few years back, actually during the time that President Trump and President Biden were going up against each other in the election. And there were businesses, big corporations, that were openly backing one candidate over another, and there was controversy over whether or not this was good business practice. Well, this week I was reading, again, this is a national article, but it was looking at whether or not businesses should outright say, we stand with Israel. And again, it's a very sensitive situation, obviously, what's going on in the Middle East. But we do have, for example, here in Connecticut, we have people who are connected to the Palestinians, and they're not connected to Hamas. But they're like, listen, because of this war now and Israel defending itself, our people are being destroyed who live in the Gaza Strip, which there's like over 2 million Palestinians there. I think it's the most dense population of Palestinians. So I was curious, going back to my initial question, good idea or bad idea for businesses to put notices or bulletins up in their windows or around their shops saying that they stand with one country over another right now, whether it's what's going on in Israel or you know, in future, whatever may come in this world that continues to see chaos. What is your professional opinion on that?
You know, that's a tough one, Melissa. You know, especially when it comes to war and things of, you know, that we, you know, are the media positions things, you know, one against the other. You know, it takes it to like a whole other level because obviously, you know, people, it's either going to resonate with people or it's not. And it could backfire on a lot of businesses. But at the same time, you know, from an employee perspective, you know, some employees may look at that as, you know, taking a stance. You know, I do think, when it comes to the war and religion and all that stuff, you know, I really feel like, you know, businesses need to not necessarily take a side, but work like they always do. And I mentioned this last week, you know, businesses are really smart and innovative and, you know, figure out the way to be the solution. Right. And, you know, you look at a lot of stuff happening in Europe, not just with this particular incident, but the immigration issues that are happening throughout Europe. And you look at some of the leaders there in the businesses, and they're saying, look, this is, yes, they're coming through our borders, but this is a European problem. And, you know, so how can we solve this as one instead of it's just my problem and not your problem? You know what I mean? So, So you know, and I know it sounds, you know, maybe too idealistic, but, you know, gosh, you know, can't we just all work together to come up with, you know, solutions that work for everybody?
Right.
So that's like one level. But at the same time, you know, when you get really granular and local, you know, I think it's great for businesses to take a stand, not necessarily in politics, but what their values are, because I do think it resonates with employees, and perhaps it has a play on retention of their employees too, right? You know, particularly, you know, I think I'm coming from the corporate space, as you know, by my prior history, but we are very involved with environmental issues. And, you know, there's definitely a group of people that were grateful for the work that we did, you know, environmentally across the country and, you know, and the values that we stood for as an organization. And I think that resonates with employees in many ways. But it's this taking it up to that next level where it's us versus them. I think that's where it crosses the line. And you know, I think maybe it's best not to, you know, put yourself out there in that way. When if you're not coming up with a solution or some way to resolve the issue, then why, you know, why bother? Why go there?
Right. I also think, Dan, it brings up a great point that I think it's okay. Like, you'll see businesses sometimes, if they support a nonprofit, for example, you know, like, let's just say, you know, I don't know, a nonprofit in Bridgeport Rescue Mission, let's just say, because we talk to them all the time. And you'll sometimes see, like, if a business donated to them or had a hand in something, they might have a plaque or something that is acknowledging it, and they'll leave leave it. They'll leave it in their front office, or they'll hang, you know, hang it on the wall behind them if it's a restaurant or something. And I think in that regard, you're sort of taking a stand, right? You're saying, I don't want people to go hungry. I don't want people to be homeless. I don't want addiction to continue to ruin our society. I supported this local nonprofit. But I think there's a difference between something like that versus when you're making a political statement, for example, where it's open to interpretation. Like, I hate to say it, but when you say I stand with Israel, the reason the Palestinians don't like it is because you're saying, okay, people are taking it literally, where you're saying, okay, I only support Israel, when unfortunately, I don't think that's what people are saying. I think people are saying, look, what happened to Israel is deplorable. What you're seeing going on in the news is absolutely horrific. And anyone who has a human heart should agree with that. But that's not saying it's okay that both Israelis and Palestinians are now suffering. I just think that when you put a generic sign like that up, you have good intentions, but it could turn off business. So I believe there's a good way to say you support something or you stand with something, but you've got to be careful of the messaging. I don't know if you agree.
Yeah, no, 100%. I think, like I said, when it can get interpreted into an us versus them, it's just not good business, right? You know, so I think you're 100% right. The messaging is key to how you support, you know, certain things, you know, particularly global issues. And it can backfire in a big way, for sure.
Just a couple more minutes with Dan Onofrio of the Bridgeport Regional Business Council. Dan, we were just talking about what businesses should do if they want to take a stance, especially on national or even international, in this case, matters like what's going on in Israel. But I was curious, even from a local standpoint. So we've got some local elections that are going to be coming up in a matter of weeks, and they're heating up. You know, I mean, I look at Bridgeport, that's become national news, what's going on with the mayoral race. And I was curious what your opinion has been on that. Like, what are you telling businesses, or maybe you haven't had to address them, but what would you say to businesses when it comes to even local politics, and should they back a certain candidate or not? Does that hurt them in the end if they're public about it? What do you think?
Yeah, that's a great question, Melissa. You know, from a business organization perspective, the BRBC, you know, we've always tried to be supportive of whoever's in the seat at the moment, right? And as a business organization, you know, we've tried not to stay, and you know, we try to stay in the middle and not necessarily get behind one particular candidate or another. But that said, it is imperative for businesses to get involved, because think about it. I mean, they're hiring people that live and work locally, right? And I think it's important that the business community has a voice and a seat at the table with our elected officials, both at the municipal level, but also regionally with our elected officials. So like the BRBC, what we do, and our role in this whole thing is really just to convene everyone and bring everyone together, because it's important for businesses to know what the mayor and, you know, the other city officials with, you know, regardless of the town or city that they represent, you know, what their visions are and what their policies are for their communities, and whether or not they're supportive of business in general, and how can they help the quality of life and all those things that resonate with businesses as they look for to recruit talent and perhaps and hopefully, you know, continue to expand within our specific region. So it's important for us to get those communities together, and we do that through our government relations committee. You know, do we do it often enough? Probably not as often as we like, but I think we do it well enough that, you know, at least the municipal leaders understand and know what the needs are of the business community. And it's important that that dialogue remains open. Now, you know, the businesses at the, you know, at that point then need to decide whether or not, just like we talked earlier, whether or not they're going to go out publicly and support a candidate or not. And, you know, and similar like in anything else, you know, and it could backfire or it could be a good thing, right? It depends on, you know, on what that business decides to do with the messaging. But, you know, but it's important that the business community at least is involved and has a seat at the table in these conversations, 100%.
Well, and again, like you said, Dan, it's also a matter of not only, yes, you certainly have to get involved because this is directly going to impact you and your business. You know, with the political stances like we were talking about before, that might turn off customers. In this regard, though, you certainly want to speak up on behalf of your business. But I would think the only concern could be that if you were to, you know, put, let's just say you put all your eggs into one basket, one candidate, and they don't get elected. What does that mean? Are you now able to really advocate for your business? Are they going to take you seriously knowing you didn't support them? Like, do you ever have concerns about that? You know, if you're very outright about, I don't want this person to stay in office or to go into office, and they get elected, does that now put your business at risk?
Yeah, it could. It could put the business at risk in the sense of, you know, getting things done, throughout the city or the municipality that they're located in, you know, and that's why I think it's important where organizations like ours can be the advocate for the business community. And I'm not saying that, we go into a room and, pound our fist on the table and say, we demand this. It's just to say, hey, look, these are the things that are important to us. These are the challenges that we're having. What can you help us do, Mr. or Mrs. Mayor, right? To address some of these issues, particularly as it relates to business recruitment, retention, and quality of life for the employees. So, it's having that two-way conversation, and again, regardless of who's in the hot seat, as I call it, whoever the mayor is at that given time, that dialogue needs to be open. And I think that's where organizations like ours can help facilitate a lot of that.
Well, Dan Onofrio, I appreciate your insight on this. Always love to get your professional opinion on these kinds of matters. And certainly they directly impact our businesses right here in our listening area. So thank you so much. And we'll talk again next week.
You're welcome, Melissa. Have a good one.
Thank you. You too. Dan Onofrio of the Bridgeport Regional Business Council here on WICC. We know from having the commissioner from the Department of Agriculture on the show very often that Connecticut has a pretty unbelievable farming industry here. We have over 5,000 farms, actually, in Connecticut, believe it or not. And October 12th every year commemorates National Farmers Day, a day that really holds special significance for local Connecticut farmers, including fourth-generation farmer Erica Hermanot and her husband, John. And we actually have Erica here today to talk all about her farm and just the significance of this industry here in Connecticut. Erica, again, is the fourth-generation farmer at Fairholme Farm, which is right here in Woodstock. Erica, welcome to WICC. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Thank you so much. Fourth generation, huh? So, like, as soon as you were born, you knew. You're like, well, guess I'm going to be doing this. Were you excited to get into that or no, not so much?
No, definitely not. Probably the opposite. At 18, I was like, how do I get out of here really quick?
Right. Listen, I get it. I come from a family business family, I should say. And luckily, I was one of five kids. So I was like, all right, somebody else, somebody else worked in health insurance. And luckily, two out of five of us somehow ended up in the health insurance sector. So I'm happy about that. But nevertheless, you did end up getting into the farming industry. How did that happen?
I ended up doing a college program that opened me up to agriculture and not so much just the family demands that come with it. Really being able to see what comes from being a farmer, not just, missing out on things. And it was a very different eye-opening experience that showed me the positive side of it, not just the negative. So it really, college changed my mind and made a phone call and said, I think I want to come home. And that was a few years ago.
Wow, that's amazing. I think that's incredible. And let's talk about your farm in Woodstock, Connecticut. Fairholme Farm has actually thrived over the last 100 years. I mean, fourth generation. Tell us about the history of this farm. That's incredible.
Yes, thank you. So October is kind of a special month for us. It's our anniversary month. My great-great-grandparents bought it in October of 1920, so we're actually 103 years this month. We started with peddling milk and cottage cheese. It's always been dairy right from the beginning. And during the Depression, that helped them get through. We had one of the first milking parlors in the area in 1960. And our next upgrade was in 2018 to robotic milking technology. So we've changed a lot in 103 years and really try to keep up and with technology and changes and how we can keep doing better both by the land and the cows. So we're currently at 400 Holstein cows we milk in 6 robots. It's both generations, so it's the third and fourth. My parents and I and my husband are working together. And we have a dedicated team of employees and support staff from vets and nutritionists that help us maintain this every day. And in the last decade, we've invested very heavily in infrastructure and technology to really improve how we can care for our herd and our land.
Wow. And I can't help but notice that you said my great-great-grandparents. So you've always had female involvement with the farm.
Yes. Yeah, so she was actually a wealthy college graduate and then married my grandfather. And so the having a woman at the table was never something that was talked about or made sure that happened. It just did. If there was a job to be done, whoever was capable of doing that job, the gender was never really something that was part of the equation. And as an adult with a young daughter, I now have a much deeper understanding and gratitude for having this be part of my upbringing. But my great-great-grandmother and my grandmother both stepped into the roles because their husbands passed away at a young age. And so they raised their children with those values that if there was a job, if you were able to do it, you did it. And that was, I mean, how all of us were raised.
That's so beautiful. I mean, that's amazing. That really is something to celebrate, that you're able to continue on such an incredible legacy. I mean, these are strong women. My gosh, continuing to raise families and running a farm. I mean,
yeah, we're very, very lucky.
Yeah, it's amazing. But clearly, you also are very strong, Erica. I mean, you come from a long line of that, but it's amazing what the farm has continued to do. I saw that it earned the prestigious Century Farm Award not too long ago. So that's incredible.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, we were pretty honored to have that. You're with very good company with that award.
So again, we have
a lot to make it a century.
No, I was going to say it takes an awful lot to make it a century. And actually, we could talk a little bit about that because farms have really had a very difficult time, especially in recent years with weather, just to put that, you know, out there. It's been very hard for farmers to keep up. So you're right about that. And again, we have Erica here, who is a fourth generation farmer at Fair Home Farm in Woodstock. It is celebrating its 103rd year operating here in Connecticut, which is extraordinary. Tell us about some of the on-farm experiences, Erica, that you offer to not only educate, but really engage people in the farming industry.
Sure. So we have always been very open to our opening of our farm to the public and providing transparency and honesty to how we farm and what modern day agriculture looks like and really trying to bridge that gap between farmers and consumers. This is nothing new. We were doing tours for our schools when we were in grade school. So over 40 years now. And we offer farm tours to schools and groups. And even get a treat afterwards. Milk and cookies is a long-standing tradition here. And during the summer, we do hay wagon farm tours. We started that after COVID. We saw a really strong push for buying local and an opportunity to open up our farm and get people here. And we go right down the middle of the cow barns. The cows are about 6 feet away. And you get to see right in the environment that they're in. You know, we can't dress anything up. It is what it is. And you get to see it for all its honesty there. And then we also do a kids farm camp. Again, this started after COVID. We've been toying with this idea for a while. And there's actually a bunch of dairy farms across the country that have modeled this camp that we really enjoyed. And we thought this would be a good area to do it in. And I'm also a 4-H leader, so I've been working with kids, and I found it was a good way to get them here and get the parents here. That's a week-long session that we run, and we did it 4 weeks this past summer.
Wow, that's amazing. Oh, my gosh. Yeah. That's so cool. October 12th is National Farmers Day. And so we have more than 5,000 farms here in Connecticut. And we are celebrating one of them this morning. Erica Hermanot is here. Am I saying your last name right? I don't feel like
I am.
Yeah,
you got it right. Don't worry.
I am? Okay, thank God.
You wouldn't believe what the automated systems do to it.
Oh, I can only imagine. Listen, with the last name Sheketov, good grief. My gosh. Whenever you have goodness, Alexa say it, it's like, oh. So, yeah, I got it. So, okay, Erica Hermanot, just making sure. Fourth-generation farmer at Fairholme Farm in Woodstock. And it's amazing. It just reached over 103 years old. It's incredible. I'm curious, Erica, sustainability. I know that's something that is talked about a lot for dairy farms. How does your farm specifically address the industry's commitment of achieving greenhouse gas neutrality by the year 2050?
So I think the biggest thing is how much our dairy cows have changed. Obviously, that's the largest part of our operation. It's kind of astounding when you look at the fact that they're 72% more efficient than they were just 18 years ago. This is mainly based on genetics, nutrition, cow comfort, how well we can take care of them. And a lot of the research that we've learned to feed and care for them has made them better and made us better as farmers. We can use 90% less land because we've learned how to take care of the land better than we did even 60 years ago, and 63% less water than it did 60 years ago. So those are huge statistics that's made us better. Specifically on our farm, we've used cover cropping for over 20 years. And this is where you'd plant a crop. It's actually what we're doing right now because we finished corn last week. And you plant a crop right in the fall, and it will come up usually within a week. And it grows until the first frost, and then as a perennial, it will come back in the spring. And it has a really important job as far as improving soil quality. It reduces runoff, holding a root system in place during months that you wouldn't normally have a crop there. It takes carbon in again during our off season. It provides green manure for the main crop, which is corn for us. We also recycle clean water on our farm. It cools our milk down, but it's used. So we'll feed it to our cows, and they love it because it comes out about 60 degrees. And we also use compost bedding. We have a big compost barn for one of our cows, or for one of our groups of cows, sorry. And we will compost that for up to a year and then sell it as fertilizer. We'll do that through our farm store.
Wow.
So I don't think all measures have to be really big. I think a lot of small change can lead to big change. We recycle our food scraps to our pigs and chickens, and we even feed potato waste from the Lay's potato factory that's about a half an hour from us to our cows. And we even thrift shop and recycle cardboard and paper, and it doesn't seem like a lot, but I think a lot of these small changes cumulatively make big change.
Definitely. And lastly, before I let you go, Erica, because I know how busy you are with National Farmers Day and just in general, knowing how big the industry is here in Connecticut, what can people do to better support and celebrate our local farmers?
So I think one of the best things, if you can't or you aren't able to support monetarily directly to a farm, I think just becoming more aware, if you don't know already how we farm and our why, to find a farm and ctdairy.org, you can find them there, or, I mean, social media, you can get an inside look at many farms, not just in Connecticut, all over their country. And just trying to learn about how we do things and why, and really, you know, we're trying to do our best, but understanding that and making the initiative to learn more if you don't already.
Yeah. And again, if you want to learn more specifically about this incredible farm right here in Woodstock, Connecticut, you can always go to they have a website. They've got a phone number as well. Fairholmefarm.com, FairHolmFarm.com, or you can find them at ctdairy.org. You also can give them a call, 860-617-3341. And I want to thank you so much again, Erica, for giving us a call and being part of this National Farmers Day and celebrating it here in Connecticut. And I hope a lot of people come and check out your farm because you're doing some really incredible things for over 100 years now. It's extraordinary. So thank you.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
All right. And again, if you want to check out more, go to their website, fairholmefarm.com, or you can find them with the other thousands of farms we have here in Connecticut at ctdairy.org. We want to welcome back to our show Dr. Vahid Bezadan, who is our cybersecurity expert. He talks about cybersecurity and artificial intelligence at the University of New Haven and right here on the morning show. He's an assistant professor of cybersecurity and networks, data and computer science, electrical and computer engineering at UNH. So he definitely knows what he's talking about. Vahid, welcome back. How are you?
Good morning, Melissa. I'm doing very well. How are you?
I'm doing fine. I'm so glad to have you here. Tell us, if you don't mind, Vahid, what has been on your radar? What's some of the big cybersecurity headlines?
Well, cybersecurity is always a busy arena, particularly with the recent events in the Middle East. A lot has been happening in terms of political activism on cybersecurity domain. There are a lot of hacktivists trying to promote one view or the other, none of which seem to have affected the general user here in the U.S., but similar to the situation with the Ukraine war, it's a proliferating scene. The cybersecurity threat landscape keeps getting darker and darker. But I don't want to scare everyone. I just want to remind your listeners that as long as they maintain basic cyber hygiene and look at anything out of the ordinary with a little bit of perspective, they're going to be on the safe side as long as they keep their systems up to date, as long as they make sure that their passwords are up to date and not reused, as long as they care about how and with who they are sharing their information, things should be relatively safe for us here in the U.S.
So that's what you mean when you say cybersecurity hygiene, is things like updating passwords, not using common phrases, making sure you have different passwords, maybe even having, like we've talked about, a VPN before to make sure you have extra security when you sign in. That's what you mean by hygiene?
Exactly. And of course, multi-factor authentication is something that we've talked about before, Melissa. Using a secondary authentication mechanism like a text message verification coming to your cell phone or apps or specific hardware designed for multi-factor authentication can be very helpful in protecting your cyber exposure, particularly when it comes to banking and critical information systems. So, with all of that, Melissa, I was wondering if we can switch to AI. I know that I typically talk about cybersecurity, but interesting things have been happening in AI and particularly AI regulation here in Connecticut.
So, yes, I do want to talk about AI. Just one more quick question, though, Vahid, because this was
sure.
a question we got. When you talk about I'm so glad you set it up where you talked about having cybersecurity, like good hygiene, essentially, because this was a great question from somebody. It was only a few weeks ago that we learned that one of our major hospital systems, I think it's in charge of three hospitals here in Connecticut, not
right.
Fairfield County per se, but there was a cybersecurity attack, and it put people at risk of their information, personal information, now being exposed, and the hospitals are still kind of scrambling and investigating just how bad this could be. Is there anything people can do? This was the question from one of our listeners. What can I do? Like in regard to cybersecurity hygiene, you only have so much control over how public entities have your information, like a hospital, like a health insurance agency, things like that. What can you do? Or do you essentially just have to trust the systems they have in place?
Well, my answer is neither. Unfortunately, there isn't much under our control when it comes to public or private healthcare providers. They are required by law to maintain certain standards and protocols when it comes to data privacy and security. Some of your listeners may be familiar with the HIPAA Act,
yes.
which is one of the strictest regulations when it comes to data privacy. But unfortunately, as I mentioned, the threat landscape is dynamic. And a single mistake by the weakest link in a system can result in the exposure of data and a breach of HIPAA. Now, when these events occur, it's very important for the customers, for the clients of those healthcare providers, to, first of all, be informed of the level of exposure. What type of information, what type of data about individual customers has been leaked? What is the risk of those exposures? Can somebody now target you because of your illness? Is there risk of identity theft? Is there risk of medical ransom and so on? And the healthcare provider, in my opinion, this is not a legal opinion. This is a technical opinion. The healthcare provider that has experienced a breach should provide support to the customers in terms of minimizing the exposure and the risk resulting from the breach. But otherwise, the only thing that we can do is to keep insisting or keep asking the healthcare providers to make sure their cyber infrastructure is secure and they are doing what they need to do. Otherwise, unfortunately, I don't see a way where clients can have control over their exposure when it comes to healthcare providers.
Yeah, I mean, I think it speaks to a bigger lesson here, Vahid, which we've talked about on this show before, which is don't react to something like that. Instead, be proactive. You know, if you are an employer listening this morning and you have a major company, or even if you have a small business of four people, but you rely on computer systems, if you have important information for your clients that you don't want exposed or put in the wrong hands, it's important to get a cybersecurity expert in there and check your systems. You know, it's important to proactively make sure that you are not being put in vulnerable situations. And that includes our hospital systems. So I appreciate that perspective, Vahid, because I think it's important. Let's talk about artificial intelligence and some new headlines that directly impacts Connecticut. Dr. Vahid Bezadan is here, who is our cybersecurity and AI expert from the University of New Haven. Tell us, Vahid, what's been on your mind with AI, and what do Connecticut residents need to know about it?
So, Melissa, it's very hard to get away from AI these days.
Yes.
From social media and recommendation systems, from Netflix and how it recommends movies to you, all the way to when you send out a job application, or even when you're applying to colleges, or even in healthcare, when you go for some forms of test. AI is almost everywhere. And there are, of course, certain aspects of this AI revolution that concern many of our fellow users of these systems, like misuse, like deepfakes, like the impact that these decision-making systems may have on individuals and the society. And all of these essentially give rise to a call for some form of government regulation. Now, this has been going on for quite a while. Europe has been very active. The European Union has passed a couple of major regulations around the development of safe and accountable AI. Some states here in the U.S. have attempted at creating different forms of regulation. Now, back in May of this year, the Connecticut House of Representatives essentially passed a law called SB 1103 that focuses on regulating the use of AI by the Connecticut government. As part of this legislation, which was signed into law by Government Lamont a few months ago, a task force was formed, comprised of legal experts, representatives of the industry, as well as academics and technical experts. I'm honored to be part of that task force, whose job is to investigate the landscape of the regulation, the regulatory, and the need for regulation in AI, and to make recommendations to the state government and the legislative arm about the next moves. One of the major issues that this task force is focusing on is accountability, making sure that we know where to point the finger when something goes wrong. And this is not just a legal problem. This is also a technical problem. AI is an automated decision maker. It gets better with more data, with more experiences. Are we going to hold the developer of an AI that has caused a faulty, deleterious event accountable for that event? Or is it up to the user who's fed the data? And also the data privacy and data, the ethical use of data is another major concern, as well as making sure that AI development remains viable and feasible while the users of AI, those who are affected by AI, are also protected by some form of regulation.
Yeah, it's certainly a lot to think about and dive into, and we know that we need oversight. We know we need regulation. It's going to be a matter of if they do it fast enough. I hate to say that, Vahid, but it's like I look at how social media and big tech has really gotten out of hand, and we're sort of too little too late. Like, we're asking now for regulation and oversight, and yet, you know, Pandora's box has already been opened. So with AI, I think we're hoping to kind of beat it to the punch, but I mean, the verdict isn't out on that one, so we'll see what happens. But I think you've brought a lot to the forefront, and I appreciate having you here. I'm sure we're going to need you back sooner rather than later, so I look forward to having you back on the show, Vahid. Thank you so much.
Always a pleasure. Thank you, Melissa.
All right. Dr. Vahid Bezadon with the University of New Haven right here on WICC.
It's time to get up and get moving. Workout Wednesday. Melissa in the morning on WICC 600.
I came across a study looking at the impacts of exercise and how it can really help older adults to lower their risk for things like dementia and Alzheimer's. And I mean, it's a significant lowering of the risk. I think it was something like 30% lowering your risk for dementia, over 40% for Alzheimer's. And so I thought this is a fantastic topic for Workout Wednesday. And Amy Linus is just the person to talk to us about it. So, hey, Amy, welcome back. How are you?
Hey, good morning, Melissa. I'm doing well. I hope you are, too.
I am. Thank you so much for asking. I mean, first of all, what have you heard about with this study? Because those are some pretty substantial findings.
They truly are. And you added to that list or reduced the reduce the risk for stroke as well, on top of all those things that you mentioned. And yes, that is a significant amount of decrease, but it is true. And I've sat through a couple of seminars on the topic, as a matter of fact. And one of the main reasons that you decrease that risk is because you have healthy carotid arteries, because those are the major blood vessels that supply your brain's blood supply, like oxygenated blood flow to the brain. So as our body mass increases as we get older and we don't take care of that with a diet, nutrition, exercise, all those wonderful things, what happens is that body mass is just too big to get that blood flow circulated properly to the brain while you're resting and sleeping and laying down.
So I'm curious, Amy, because again, when you hear these findings, I think people are going to jump at the opportunity to do anything they can to elongate their lives and to avoid such horrific health issues. I mean, dementia, Alzheimer's, I think one of the most heartbreaking things about those, I've experienced them firsthand, not myself, but I'm saying family members who've had it, and it's horrible. I don't know who suffers more, the person who's going through it, obviously, or the family and loved ones who just watch them deteriorate and not remember things. I mean, it's awful. So for people listening who are like, all right, I want to jump on the exercise bandwagon then, what would you suggest? What are some of the most common exercises that maybe won't push you to getting hurt or anything like that, but can really help in this regard?
Well, since we're speaking about the cardiovascular system and making sure that's nice and healthy, I would suggest starting out with walking and counting your steps daily. And once you advance from there, adding in some weight training and really start to strengthen those muscles. And, you know, another benefit too, Melissa, is that it can actually reduce osteopenia and osteoporosis. It can increase bone density as well, weight training and taking good care of yourself that way. I actually had some one-on-one experience, firsthand experience with a client I worked with for over 12 years, and she reversed all those things. And we got her bone density way up, and she started feeling great, feeling so much better with more energy. And overall, it was just an amazing experience, to say the least.
So another thing I was curious about, Amy, is do you suggest that older adults get some kind of either a trainer or go to see someone or like, you know, even get on YouTube or get on your site and just have somebody to kind of help them to figure out what would be a good exercise like that would fit their every day? Like, I would think that you'd want to have some kind of guidance in this regard, especially if exercising is not part of your regular routine.
Oh, yes, most definitely. Number one, for injury prevention. And number two, because when you first start something, let's face it, it's not going to be easy at first. You're going to have to go through a little bit of soreness and getting used to that. So if you tackle it on your own, the likelihood of you not continuing past week one or two is pretty great. So I would highly recommend you have somebody hold you accountable for the first, let's just say, 2 to 4 weeks when you're getting started. So absolutely, I highly recommend that. And, you know, feel free, you guys, to reach out to me as a source of reference and also my website. I'm more than happy to help and provide you guys with the information you need to get you started.
Yeah, that would be great. And the other thing too, Amy, really quick before I give people your information, if you are getting into, you know, exercising, especially for, you know, long-term health reasons, like we were saying, to lower your risk for things like stroke, Alzheimer's, dementia, how much exercise are we talking about? Are we talking about going to the gym for an hour? Are we talking about running a mile? Or does it not have to be that rigorous?
It does not have to be that rigorous. Just meet yourself where you are and do something that you want to set yourself up for success, not failure. So start out with, let's just say, a 10-minute walk if you haven't done anything in a really long time. And then from there, each week, try to tack on an extra 5 minutes until you reach about 60 minutes of cardiovascular working out, mainly being walking or weight training or whatever it may be. But yeah, start out. The main point I want to anchor home today is start. Start somewhere. You have to start somewhere. And you're not too old to get started now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really great point. So, Amy, what is your website? If people want to connect with you, ask more questions, maybe get your help on this, where do they go?
Oh, sure. It's www.amylinas.com. It's amylinas.com. I'm also on Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook. And Melissa, I just wanted to remind your listeners that I post a workout Wednesday video every Wednesday. So be on the lookout for that, you too.
Yeah, definitely keep an eye out for that. And Amy, thank you so much. Such great information. And again, very encouraging to make some of those daily changes can help us in the long run. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Melissa. I'm looking forward to next week with you, and thank you for having me on today.
Of course. I can't do a Wednesday without our Amy Linus, right? Amy Linus here of Workout Wednesday on WICC.